Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy. And with me is first-time co-host Jordan Morris.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Jordan, you are about the biggest internet celebrity I've had on this podcast, except for my dear brother.
I don't know. And, I am not bigger than Dan McCoy. I'm happy to be number two to Dan.
But for people who don't know you, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Jordan Morris. I am a writer and podcaster, maybe most relevant to this show. I am the writer of a upcoming YA graphic novel called Youth Group, the story of a bunch of goofy teenage exorcists, script by me, art by a great artist named Bowen McGurdy, and that is available for pre-order now. I think it'd be great for a 10th grader and great for, you know, an adult reader who loves spooks, jokes, a little bit of romance, a couple of feelings. Youth Group. It's coming out soon.
This time, we are doing Ray Bradbury's 1950 short story, The Veldt, which is, I think of all of the Bradbury short stories, the one that gets taught the most in high schools, or at least when I was a kid, it was the one that was taught most in high schools. What's your history with this story?
No history, really. I just, you sent over a nice little batch of options, and I saw Ray Bradbury on there. He's always a guy that I've wanted to read more of. I, of course, read Fahrenheit 451 in high school, like we all did and should. And, and I don't think I've read much else by him. My dad always tried to get me to read The Martian Chronicles. My dad was a big Martian Chronicles fan. And, yeah, maybe just some, you know, some teen stubbornness, but I never did it. I think it was one of those things. He probably got it for me three Christmases in a row, and I never cracked a single copy. He's always kind of been in the back of my head, and I know people love him, and I know his work's been adapted so many times. And I love a good short story, so I think this was a fun little excuse to get to know Ray Bradbury a little bit more.
Speaking of adaptations, my first exposure to The Veldt was in the form of there was a radio series that was on when I was in high school called Bradbury 13 that ran on NPR, which used to not only be news, it used to also have radio drama.
Right.
And that changed sometime in, I don't know, the 80s or 90s or something like that. They did 13 adaptations of Ray Bradbury stories, and The Veldt is the one that I remember from that. I remember that, and there was another one called Kaleidoscope that I remember from those, and both of those had tragic ending, so I guess that appealed to something in my teenage years. And then, you know, I went on to read a lot of Bradbury, as you do when you're a kid. This is an interesting story. It was originally published in the Saturday Evening Post, and I find that hard to believe right now, that this fantastical short story could be published in a mainstream middle America magazine. But it was the 50s.
It is so fun. It is so sci-fi-y. And I don't really know much about the Saturday Evening Post, but I do know, of course, the Norman Rockwell covers. So I imagine the Saturday Evening Post was something that just, you know, Jane and Joe suburbs got and read. And yeah, this I'm sure was kind of shocking for the time. I will say it has a little bit of an old man yells at cloud quality to it. And like it's a real these kids today type of story that I maybe the like, you know, parents in the reading audience kind of related to. This seems like a rebuke of video games that kind of came, you know, 30 years early. Of course, if you haven't read it, it is about a futuristic home where the kids have a nursery that kind of conjures up anything in their imagination. Of course, they're imagining a lot of like 50s kids stuff. So they're like imagining Aladdin and, you know, I think there's a Robinson Crusoe type, you know, story that they kind of bring up. But they're mostly imagining Africa. And yeah, so I guess that was probably like where a lot of kids' stories were set back in the day. Yeah, so it feels a little bit like, you know, these kids are always glued to their video games and their Minecrafts. Yeah, I don't know. I see both ends. I'm like, oh, this probably was a shocking, weird sci-fi dark romp, but also, you know, I think if you're a parent and you are kind of perplexed by the stuff your kid's into, this is like the story speaking right to you.
I've done previously Fahrenheit 451 and The Martian Chronicles for this podcast, and one of the things that has become quite apparent from reading a lot of Bradbury is that he does have this strong reactionary side to him. Today, Fahrenheit 451 is a darling of people who are pro freedom of the press and anti book banning. But if you reread Fahrenheit 451, the story is about a world in which people decided that they couldn't write things because they might hurt people's feelings.
Right.
And so really it's a story of wokeness gone amok.
Right. Too many these snowflakes.
So Bradbury always had this in him, and certainly by the end of his life, he was quite vocal about his politics. That doesn't make him, I think, any less fun to read, if you're like me, a bleeding heart liberal. But and certainly probably delights a lot of people out there who aren't bleeding heart liberals. Yeah, I do think that this story has a kind of a reactionary streak to it. Although I will say, one of the things about Bradbury is he never really explains his science. He's not really concerned with science or technology. Yeah. It's just all like hand wavy. Oh, yes, there's this room that makes things magically appear. You would think that at the time what he's reacting to might have been television or radio. Today, we actually have stuff that is much closer to what this story describes.
Yeah.
We have technology that absolutely will cut you off from the outside world, that will provide an alternative world that you can become lost in, you can become disconnected from the real world in. So in a weird way, the story has become more relevant.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all great sci-fi, it's kind of predictive. Yeah, it really like gets a lot of stuff right. I mean, I really was surprised when I checked the publication date and saw that it was, yeah, the 50s. It's like, yeah, what was he reacting to? What was he like, yeah, what was he like extrapolating on? And yeah, it is pretty crazy. Yeah, and you know, like also, you know, bleeding heart liberal over here, but yeah, I mean, I think there's like this stuff is worth commenting on and worth thinking about, like, you know, what technology does to us and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And I think it's kind of funny that there's an element to this story where like the parents don't really know how it works and are afraid that the kids are like manipulating it. I love that. I think that's the greatest detail, because it's like, I think when, you know, people are afraid of new technologies, there's a certain amount of like, I don't understand this. My kids can work this and I can't. I thought that was a really fun little detail. Just the fact that they have this thing and they're super unsure of what it actually is and what it does.
One of the ways this really does feel mid-century to me, though, is the technology is all tied specifically to rooms of the house.
Uh-huh.
The way it's conceived is the parents have bought this brand name house. It's called what, like a Happy Time house?
Yeah, it's got a very like on the nose, you know, dark sci-fi name. It's like a little too cheerful. Yeah, and it's like, I think it is the Happy Homemakers Dream Home or something.
And they talk about it not in terms of this specific technology or system or whatever. They talk about it like, oh, the kitchen does this and the nursery does this. And it reminded me very much of those 1950s films you see where they say the kitchen of the future.
Right. Yeah.
It's all geared at time saving and convenience. The parents like the home because it does things like cook for them and tie their shoes.
Yeah, there's a shoe tying machine. That is like the most comedy detail of this thing is like, you know, technology has gone so far that there's a shoe tying machine. That is the silliest detail, I think.
The parents, as you say, don't really know what's going on with the kids. But the kid, every time they go into the nursery, as it's called, the nursery is this room that creates realistic environments. It's never quite clear exactly how real those things are. I think one of the strengths of the story is because Bradbury is determined not to actually try to justify anything he does.
Right.
This is basically the holodeck, except that at the beginning of the story, we're told nothing in here can actually hurt you or mm-hmm. interact with you. By the end of the story, that seems to not be the case, and how we get from A to B is not explained, but yeah. So the parents are coming in and they're seeing their kids want to spend all the time in the veldt, which I don't know if kids ever want to spend all their time in the veldt. I don't know if it's a word that most kids are familiar with.
Yeah, I know. You gotta like, I feel like I spent a lot of time thinking about like, oh, what were the kids' stories of this time? Like, what are these kids like? Yeah, what got them so into Africa? Yeah, maybe it is just like encyclopedias or something. But yeah, I wonder if there was like popular, maybe like, is Tarzan a thing at this point, right? Like, it's gotta be, right? I mean, I don't know when Tarzan was popular, but it seems like a real 1950s ass thing to be popular.
Yeah, I think Tarzan, the first books were written in like the 20s or 30s, and
yeah.
Then they were certainly serialized into movies. I think it's Bradbury's own childhood readings that he's focused on here.
Oh, you might be right.
Because Bradbury, as I mentioned in another episode, he was an autodidact. He did not go to college. He spoke disparagingly of college. I'm not clear whether or not he actually thought it was a waste of time or he just couldn't afford it. And so later in his life, he sort of rationalized that. But he made up for a lack of formal education by going to the library every chance he could get and reading things. But like a lot of autodidacts, he had a very strange idea of what an education was. It was all entirely classical stuff, you know, like reading the Greeks and the Romans and Shakespeare. And then he read a lot of 19th century stuff. So maybe he was reading Haggard, you know, like King Solomon's Mines or something like that. He was reading Victorian stories of people going off into the jungles or whatever. You know, if it really were the 1950s, I think the kids would be spending all their time in the West.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, probably the Western is the pop genre of the time.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
The kids are named Peter and Wendy.
Yeah.
Which seems very like it should mean something,
uh-huh.
You know, like, but I didn't, I thought about it and I really couldn't come up with an explanation other than like Peter Pan and Wendy, they run away from home and they live in a world of make-believe.
Yeah, that was my analysis too. It's just like, yes, these are the names of kids who, right, you know, is Never Never Land real? Is it something the kids are just imagining? So yeah, and I think these kids are spending all their time in a world which might be imaginary or might be real. So yeah, I think that was the symbolism, but couldn't tell you for sure.
There was a part where the parents are calling a friend who is a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And these parts were some of the funniest parts for me. It seems like Bradbury has very little understanding of psychology or interest in understanding it. The psychologist's name is David McLean, and the line he gives when George, the father, takes him in, the psychologist says, "It certainly doesn't feel good." George says, "I want facts, not feelings." And the psychologist replies, "My dear George, a psychologist never saw a fact in his life. He only hears about feelings, vague things. This doesn't feel good, I tell you. Trust my hunches and my instincts." I think there's a lot of licensed therapists out there that would have a bit of a problem with this.
Right. Yeah. I think this was probably a time when psychologists were seen as, kooks or head shrinkers. That tracks to me that he's skeptical of it.
It's a very vivid story. Where were the points where you maybe got a little shiver down your spine, or the parts where you laughed out loud, or something that was inartfully spoken, or
I like the vagueness of it. I like that it's about how technology creeps in a way where we don't understand it. I think that's really really well observed. Like, I think we all have a technological advance or two that we're really scared of. And yeah, I think big part of that is just that, like, we don't get it. And we can kind of imagine how it could go wrong, but we don't know if that's actually possible. And I think that's, like, kind of what the parents are going through in the opening scene, is that, like, they don't know for sure if the lions can kill them. Like, they think that they can't. They're pretty sure it's just mirrors and diodes or whatever, however he kind of explains it. But yeah, I think that's really cool and a great observation about, how technology can be scary. And that ending is great. That ending is great with, like, the little kids coming and just saying, it's something like, "Can we get you a spot of tea?" to the psychologist who is about to be eaten, or you suspect is about to be eaten. Creepy little kid, great horror trope. I think, from the twins in The Shining to all the other creepy little kids that I can't think of right now. But yeah, I love that, like, there's this kind of ambiguity of, like, did the kids do this on purpose? Did they think that the parents were going to take away the nursery and, like, did one of the kids get into the mainframe or whatever and, program the lions to kill? Like, I love it. I love how you are kind of in the position of the parents, where you are saying, like, I don't get this. I don't know what this thing can do. Maybe it can kill me. Maybe that it killed my kids. It's like, I think there's, I don't know if this is part of it, but I also kind of had this element of, like, maybe the kids are dead. Like, maybe what the parents are seeing are, like, projections and the, simulation killed the kids long ago. I don't know if that's, like, a popular interpretation or not, but I even kind of had this element of, like, maybe the kids are dead. I think it's, like, ambiguous in the best way.
One of the ways that I thought it was wonderfully ambiguous is the parents go into the nursery and they can't find the kids. I mean, ostensibly, this is a room in their house. And even if it's all projections on the wall, they should be able to, like, look around the 8x10 room and find their kids somewhere. Somehow these kids have actually gone into this simulation. And that seems very pertinent to the way we deal with things like virtual reality and simply just being on the internet, and the way in which you can get lost in so many ways, and people who are looking for you might not be able to pull you out of it.
So
all those things, and again, that's why this story is powerful, is because Bradbury didn't take the time to try to explain anything. In fact, when he does sort of explain things, that's when you're kind of like, whatever. The other thing that struck me as you were talking about creepy kids, Bradbury has a lot of stories with creepy kids in it. And Bradbury in the 1950s, a lot of his short stories got made into EC comic books.
Oh, yeah.
Crypt of Terror and stuff, but mostly like the strange fantasy, the science fiction line that EC Comics did. And Bradbury's stories are perfectly made for that. They are barely stories in a way. They're kind of more like an idea that he pulls out and he like strings along for a little bit. And you can very easily compact that into like a 4-page comic adaptation or a 6-page comic adaptation. It reminds me, here I'm going to get really insider baseball. This reminds me of, you watched Mad Men, right?
I did, yeah.
Yes. You remember Ken Cosgrove was a character on that show, the guy who lost his eye. Mm-hmm. He had a second life writing science fiction stories.
Right.
And every time he would talk about one of his science fiction stories, they were these crazy sort of not stories. They were more like a concept, like, oh, here's the story about a robot who can only add or subtract a bolt from a bridge or something. And it reminded me very much of that era of science fiction where you basically just came up with some sort of a thought experiment and that was your story.
Yeah.
there were no characters. There was not much plot.
Right. Yeah. And you know, like, obviously this is a sci-fi theme that has come back. There's, you know, millions of the simulation has run amok stories. I mean, how many Star Trek holodeck episodes have we had over the course of the series? Every Star Trek series has at least one, right? And it's to the point where it's like at the point this was published, like the idea was mind blowing. And now, like, if you want to do one of these, you have to round the characters out a little bit, because everyone in this is basically a very one-dimensional character. Mom and dad, Peter and Wendy, the mean old psychologist, and no one really has an inner life or goals or anything like that, but they are just there to kind of represent older people scared by technology and kids who are too into it.
I love your analysis of them as older people scared by technology. It really does feel at the beginning like they are looking for the remote.
Yeah, it is like trying to help your mom download Hulu if you're our age.
It seems to me like this is a perfect sort of a short story to assign in schools. And although you said this was your first time reading it, I have seen this assigned in a lot of school curricula, but I don't know if it still is assigned in school curricula. When I was growing up, when I was coming up in school, and I'm Gen X, we got a lot of boomer science fiction in our, it was sort of like this generation of English teachers came along. They decided they're going to teach what they want to teach. So they taught a lot of Bradbury, some Heinlein. I don't know if it's still current to be teaching Bradbury today. And I don't know if you probably don't know. So I'm asking my listeners out there, you millennials, you Gen Zers out there, let me know. Did you get taught Bradbury in high school? Did you read Bradbury on your own?
I mean, this would be a really interesting thing to discuss with, a bunch of kids who are super into video games and the internet and et cetera, whose parents are probably weird about it, right or wrong. So it would be kind of interesting to see which side of this the kids came down on.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is the today, I think at the time it was more of an exploration of how technological advances were causing people to become unable to do things for themselves. That's one thing that they keep talking about, is the parents are losing the ability to cook for themselves. The kids have no ability to entertain themselves beyond this. I think someone reading it today will immediately make, as you did, the association with video games. And certainly now, in the year of our Lord 2024, we think about it in terms of things like AI.
Sure.
Whether or not simulations have this kind of an emerging consciousness. When I was reading this, I thought about something that I once been told, and I really wish I could cite the author, because I should cite the author. This isn't my idea. The person was saying, you know, that the whole Turing test thing is sort of beside the point. The question is not whether or not our simulations will develop consciousness. It's whether or not they will be so like consciousness to us that we will start to treat them that way. Mm-hmm. And he was talking specifically about like video games. If you kill a character in a video game that can beg for its life, mm-hmm. and can, in a convincing way, doesn't that do something to you? Doesn't that coarsen you, whether or not that simulation suffers or not? For me, reading this story, part of the implication is it doesn't matter whether or not the simulation is real. What matters is what it has done to the kids, that what interacting with that simulation has done to the kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we spend a lot of time thinking about, like, can the AI think? It's like, well, I don't know if it can think. It's, you know, it, who cares? It's not real. It's not a being. But right, will it? Is the shitty stuff that AI can do, is that, that's maybe what we should focus on, rather than like, is it alive? It's like, no, it's not. But you know, let's make sure it doesn't take people's jobs.
You heard it here first. You know, this is a short story. I think we're kind of running out of things here to say. But do you have anything else you'd like to add here at the end?
Gosh, yeah, not really. I did a little just browse of the Wikipedia, and I guess Stephen Colbert read it on NPR at some point in the 2010s. And I think that there is it's an electronic artist. I want to say Moby has like a song or video that's inspired by it. These aren't things that I've actually experienced, just stuff I read on Wikipedia that I'm parroting back because I thought they were interesting when I read them 10 minutes ago.
Well, when I was just before this podcast, I was searching for my notes on my computer, which is titled The Felt. And one of the things that came up was that Combustible Edison did a song called The Felt.
Oh,
so I'll
okay.
have to go back and listen to that. Anyone out there remember Combustible Edison? Big for maybe 2 months in the early 90s during that whole lounge music craze. That was a thing we lived through.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and I would recommend anyone who's interested, do look up the Bradbury 13 radio play. It's available on the Internet Archive. It's available on YouTube. It dates from a time when there wasn't a lot of radio drama being made anymore. Today, you know, we have podcasts and everybody and their mother seems to have a audio drama of some sort going on. I think this generation has revitalized the form. But in the 80s, there was almost nothing happening. And this was a real eye-opener to me, listening to the Bradbury 13 episodes on NPR. And NPR, if you're listening, you know, break the news cycle once in a while and play something else.
Yeah, no, gosh. I also remember the days when, like, NPR would do stuff like this. And, yeah, I mean, we listened to The War of the Worlds on Halloween. They might still do that. They might actually still do that, at least on our NPR station over here. But, yeah, that was always really fun when it would pop up on the weekends.
Okay, unless you have anything else more to say, I think that's good. It's a half hour episode, which is good for a short story.
Thanks for having me, and I would love for folks to check out Youth Group, the upcoming graphic novel from me and Bowen McGurdy, if you want to check it out. bit.ly/youthgroupbook, bit.ly/youthgroupbook, and you can check out the cover, some of the art, and you get all those pre-order links. We love a pre-order. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to guest host Jordan Morris. If you have an idea for a book, story, poem, or other reading to cover on a future episode, or a suggestion for a guest host, or if you simply like to say hi, you can write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. I love to hear from listeners. The Sophomore Lit theme song is by Malcolm Nygaard. This podcast is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. Jordan, you froze on my end, and I assume I froze on your end. But I'm sure you've recorded whatever it was you were saying. Yeah. So,
I mean, I'll do that one more time. One more time. Third time's a charm.
The Incomparable Podcast Network. Become a member and support this show today. TheIncomparable.com/members.